Welcome back to another exciting episode of Extra Features. These guys are up early and making me stay up late. Don't like it. But it's all good. They're from Australia, and I'm going to screw up their names like I do every day, but we're going to try. I have the director of Risen, Tony Radsky.
Wrong.
Told ya. And Pete Ireland.
Yay! There you go. One from two.
So, and their film Risen is coming out soon. So yeah, let's get into this. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's just about to play. And you know, this is lovely of you to chat to us, because it's about to play at the First Lens Film Festival in LA. And it's got it's nominated for 5 festival awards there. So we're pretty excited.
Has it screened there yet?
I think it's screening there in American time. I think it's tonight in LA time, or what? Oh, maybe tomorrow.
That makes sense. They're behind me.
Yeah. So yeah, I think it's tonight.
Awesome. So I want to start right at the beginning. You do I wrote down a CGI opener. So how much color correction and CGI did you add to the beginning of the film? Right off the beginning, or did you just drone shoot this? I was really trying to figure this out.
No, it's actually completely CGI. So okay. The idea was to kind of establish, because the opening shot is this kind of tracking shot, aerial drone shot, kind of going up into the air, showing this kind of divided space. You know, there's on one side, it's kind of like the have and have nots, basically. One side is green and beautiful and lush, and the other side is a unkempt kind of industrial space. And there's a kind of divide in the middle.
Yeah. It was an opportunity that came up a bit later in the piece, because basically this story is about this kind of world that's divided by a drug that it's like a drug epidemic, and kind of like the opioid crisis in the real world. But what the drug does is it causes people to float off the ground. That's the kind of side effect. So, you know, you can imagine a world where instead of, if you went outside and, you know, you can't see people who are potentially drug addicts and that sort of thing, drug users. But imagine if you went outside and just through the sky are all of these people floating who are, you know, impacted by the drug. And so that's the kind of the effect of that on the world, on society and that sort of thing. And so we were getting pretty far into post-production on the film, and Tony, being the great director that he is, he sort of looked at it, and we'd established these two different worlds, the wealthy side and the not wealthy side, in the kind of physical space and the color, the color correction, as you say. You know, the nice area is very green, the not nice area is kind of browns and yellows and that sort of stuff. But Tony looked at the cut and said, We just need something more dramatic to kind of, you know, elevate that beginning and really let us know where we are. And so he came up with this amazing shot where it's, you know, there's the fence line that's dividing the two worlds. And there's, if you look at it, there's all these, off the tops of buildings, there's all these people on ropes where, like, cause the idea is that people who are regular users, they like tie themselves off so that they don't, you know, float up into the sky and then fall to their death. And so he's even got lots of little details of like, floating people on ropes off the tops of buildings and all that kind of stuff. So, and that was just something that came to him sort of later in the piece, sort of going, we need something really amazing and dynamic to set up the world. And then luckily our VFX friends were happy to help us make that shot, because we came up with it much later in the piece.
Okay. I do have lots to get into, but let's just stay with the CGI for a bit. How long did you spend on the CGI, and how much time did you spend editing it into the film? Because there is a ton of CGI work in this.
Yeah. I mean, when writing the script, you're very conscious of making sure that the CGI is used in a clever way. You know, like, it's important to the story. It makes sense. It's not just there because it looks cool, you know? So we were really critical about it at a script stage, and essentially mapped out a whole bunch of shots that we're like, we need to have this needs to be CGI.
We did
a lot of tests beforehand, just Pete and I, on a green screen, on a box, kind of fake floating, looked really bad.
There's so many weird tests where, like, we've got these shots and it's Brady sent it to me from time to time, and we just laugh about it, where it's like there's a woman that's like this beautiful angelic woman floating in the film, but it's me instead with like a
bed sheet. Test, of course.
In the test.
Oh, okay, because I'm like, that's you. That's impressive.
No, it only, in a bed sheet, nothing else.
In a bed, like with a bed sheet draped over me just to test what the white dress would look like. They're so weird, but they're very funny to look at, yeah.
But, yeah, so to answer your question, from the inception, you know, script stage, we kind of mapped it out. And, you know, CGI is time-consuming, it's expensive and all those things. And so, you know, we're conscious of that. So basically, you know, in the edit, we kind of mapped out how many shots were there, 20-odd shots that had CGI in them or an element of CGI in them, including the kind of big opening.
And he did mock-ups too. He's an excellent visual artist, so he did like still frame mock-ups as well to really test it.
And you're doing lots of things like, you know, you're shooting empty plates where the you know the characters will be, you know, in post when we throw them into the edit. So there's a lot of empty frames in the film when we're editing where the people were going to exist, you know, in that space.
Yeah.
So go ahead.
No, sorry, I was going to say, and in terms of time, I mean, it ended up taking us about a year, to be honest. Like, we didn't want it to take that long, but, you know, again, you want it to look good. And one of the pieces of advice we got from an executive producer, a mentor of ours, basically said, listen, I've watched a lot of these sci-fi things that are kind of a way of selling a bigger world and maybe a feature or a TV series, and they all let themselves down in the CGI. So really, don't do it quick. Spend the time. Make it look good, because that will really sell the world. And a lot of these other ones, like there was one about, like, I don't know, a movie about an inner light thing, and they just said, and it was setting it up and they were building up to this big crescendo where inner light was going to be this big thing, and it looked like a torch had been stuck to the front of the person, and they just kind of went, yeah, it doesn't work. So they said, just really invest the time. So yeah, we did.
Well, I think your film works because it feels like a real world. Like, I feel this is a world I would see more than a video game, than a movie. Like, I could see you having this as a prologue to my video game. Maybe that's what you were going for at one point, because I definitely feel. Now, my question is, whereas always the film is obviously called Risen. Is that to do with the people going up in the air? Is that why we have Risen, or is it something else?
Yeah, essentially it's that. It's you know, obviously there's kind of biblical.
Well, that's what I was going for. Like
that. Yeah, the intention. Having said that, my first documentary is called The Prodigal Son, which has nothing to do with religion. But Risen, yeah, I mean, there's a certain biblical nature to it too. Mm. You know, this idea of rising up, and rising up of the oppressed. You know, are these drug users who are kind of, you know, they're oppressed by society, they're pushed away, and there is a kind of religious element, not intentionally, but I love that idea of kind of this group of people who have been pushed away, quite literally up into the sky, you know, kind of forgotten. But they can't be forgotten because they're littering the sky, and once their heat wears off, they plummet to essentially their death if they're not tethered. So
and they become the Fallen, which is a title that's like a naming convention in that world, where that's why one of the characters asks the lead whether his parents are fallen, which is people who have, you know, become reckless and they didn't tether themselves and they floated too high and then they came down and that was the end of them. So
okay, you have another beautiful shot through a grate. So I know you know the shot I'm looking at, and I want to know. When you're shooting that shot, are you CGI those bars in, or are you on the other side of the grate? Because it's a beautiful shot. So I was kind of like, is it, which way is it? Did you shoot it both ways?
That was in studio, actually.
Ah! so it's not the same place. Okay.
No, it's not the same place. No, so basically we couldn't actually get through to the we couldn't shoot through that grate, actually. And so we set up a shot in the studio on the green screen day with little pillars, little foam pillars to mimic that.
So. Yeah, it was a real achievement of our production designer. So our production designer, she was really, because she, like, you know, really collaborated so strongly to kind of make sure that, you know, kind of the feeling that you called out, where the world really felt real, you know. And that was one of the things where we kind of threw it and said, you know, we need something, we can't make it work in the actual location. Can you make us something that is kind of a rig so that we can do these things, so we can get that real closeness to the face and all that sort of thing and make it work? And, yeah, she whipped something up really quickly. But it just, it had, she was really focused on texture, so making sure that, the this kind of setup that we had had the texture that we needed around the concrete and that sort of stuff. And it really worked. So it was very clever and she did it very fast. So, yeah, a big
There's lots of cheating in the film. Yeah, a big shout out to our
creative collaborators.
See, and you didn't think I was even to call you out on that shot going something.
Like, but are you saying that? Are you saying that looks shit? Is that what you're saying?
No, I think it looks beautiful, but I'm like, I want to get into the location, but the location's dirty. So it's kind of like, how did that shot work? Because it doesn't fit. But I'm fussy and I look for these things. So most people, I'm sure, would just go, whatever, and move along. I want to discuss that location. How did you find that? Or is that all extra work added? Like, is the graffiti real and all that stuff real?
Yeah, that's actually my local dog park.
You're kidding me.
No, so we added graffiti and we added all this, you know, stuff to the walls and kind of gave it a more gritty kind of look and a gritty feel. But that's actually a dog park, and there's a big kind of fence line that's quite tall that runs along that dog park, which kind of worked with this idea of kind of being kind of fenced in on one side, you know. But that literally is where I take my dog every day.
Yeah. And Tony also did heaps of work. You know, when it, like, we talk about the VFX at one end being, you know, quite a process. All the location scouting was a huge, and particularly in short films, location scouting generally is a huge piece of work, particularly when you're world building. And so, yeah, we went to so many different places. You know, every time we were driving anywhere, you know, you would literally see out of the corner of your eye.
See something industrial and go, metal industry.
And you would, like, pull over to see it.
But Australia's so limited in terms of spaces like this, you know, particularly Sydney, because we're so developed, you know, and places like this that have this kind of, you know, warehousey, industrial, kind of mechanical feel are kind of being ripped down and apartments are being built. So, you know, it's hard in a place like Sydney to find, that's so urbanized and becoming more urbanized, to find spaces that feel kind of lived in, you know, and old and has texture and history. You know, we're kind of ripping history away and replacing it with beautiful apartments. Beautiful.
Very jealous of North America and what the Americans and new Canadians have, because you guys have a lot of, like, you know, those buildings that you don't necessarily tear them down. And it just, it creates a sort of a tapestry that you can use and you can plug into, whether it's modern or old or industrial. And we don't, literally, as soon as a factory stops being used, somebody rips it down and builds a apartments. You know, that's kind of the way it's working in Australia at the moment. So, yeah.
It's starting to happen here too a bit. Even in my neighborhood, I've noticed things. You guys are 20 years too young. You had to be in Toronto 20 years ago and you would have found everything you needed. Old abandoned warehouses everywhere.
Yeah.
Now, your second location is the suburbs. And these, because obviously these places, to me, don't look like they should even be near each other. But obviously your second location in the movie is close to your first location. I don't really care. My real question is, how close is it to the real location and whose doors did you use?
Wow. Yeah. So, so the idea is, you know, there's the two spaces in this world, the greens, we call it, which is a nice, lovely kind of suburban area. And then we've got the kind of outer west, which is the industrial space. So the greens actually is at half an hour, 40 minute drive from our main location. And I actually saw it in a, what's that TV show with Jane Campion that she directed?
Top of the Lake 2,
I think.
Yeah,
well, and I saw a shot of this crazy suburb that looked really Stepford Wives. You know, it was just insane. Like, every house was beautiful, but kind of the same, you know. And then, you know, I had, you know, we made calls and I think you knew somebody who worked on it.
I randomly knew somebody who worked on Top of the Lake called them up and just said, this shot, where was it? And she said, it's this neighborhood. And so,
and then we went door knocking. And so we went there and we drove in this, it's a new suburb next to, like, the beach. And we just door knocked and we looked at houses and we door knocked and we spoke to people and, you know, they were interested in the project and the, you know, particularly the main house where the body's kind of left on the doorstep like that. I mean, but it's incredible. Even that suburb to us, we look at that suburb living in the suburbs here and we go, what the fuck is this place? Like, it is extraordinary, you know? And so I really wanted to have that stark difference. Do you know what I mean? Like, you look at it and you're kind of shocked going,
where the fuck is this?
Yeah, yeah. No, it's that McMansion, that kind of that. It's like a forest of McMansions where every third house is the same. It's really, it's a really odd place. Even to, it's one of those places where even if you're driving around, I think we even on our shooting days, we were driving around in it. And you would actually get lost and go, oh, wait, I think I'm two streets over, you know, because it just, everything just looks the same. Yeah. Yeah.
But look, it's you know, each to their own.
Oh, look, look, they're happy. They're loving it. You know, they've got big backyards and pools and these luxurious houses and that sort of stuff. I guess for us who are from, you know, we're both from neighborhoods that are a bit more kind of 70s, 80s suburban with a bit of industrial. So to us coming into something with that sort of crystalline perfection.
It's very Dorothy looking.
Yeah, it feels very, yeah, yeah, Wizard of Oz.
Okay, back. So what's your pitch? You knock on this person's door. Hi, how's it going? What's your pitch? Yeah, let's hear it.
Basically, it's like, hey, do you like drugs? No, essentially the pitch is, it's funny because, you know, you don't want to overstate the drug aspect, right?
Yeah.
But what you do state is, you know, we've got funding from Screen Australia, you know, so you've got, you know, you've been kind of tapped saying, hey, this is worth something to us. So we've got that on our side. And so automatically they go, oh, okay, it's reputable.
And Berlin LA Talents as well, because the script was developed as part of the, as part of the Berlin Film Festival. So he's right. You use those kind of those prestigious
right up front, right up front. And then you,
we're not crazy. This is the,
and then we say, what do you think about needles? No, but you know, like it's like, but you put that on the back end. Do you know what I mean? And a lot of them are engaged, you know, because, you know, they know the world, you know, people have seen the effects of drugs, even in Australia, you know, methamphetamine, ice is a big issue, you know, here too. So I think they really responded to the material and kind of found it strange but also really intriguing. So I think that you know, that was kind of our pitch.
Yeah, so you kind of you start with the prestige elements to make them feel like you've been vetted, so that you're not a crazy person who's going to come in and steal their stuff
and then add blood to their door,
and then, yeah, and then get them on side and make them feel a part of it creatively. Yeah. and then really, you know talk to them about, you know, you'd be welcome to the premiere, and just made them feel like they were part of the team making the thing. And then it sort of got its own sort of forward momentum. Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to go back to locations because I'm just fascinated by some of your.
No, please.
Okay. You have a hallway off Trafalgar Street, and I want to discuss the lighting of that tunnel.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Yeah, the tunnel.
Was that color corrections later, or was you actually lit it into those colors?
Yeah, so basically that tunnel has gone through so many iterations of graffiti, being cleaned, being dumped on, being cleaned over the years. So that tunnel goes under a well-known place called Newtown in Sydney, and it's incredible. And so basically when we did our tests, the tunnel was painted over, still aged, but painted over. And at the time, Australia was going through a marriage equality thing. So, you know, it's like we had lots of kind of paint, you know, pictures on walls and graffiti around town supporting marriage equality. And so this tunnel was painted in amazing colors along the way. So when we arrived the second time at the location, it was painted. We were like, oh my God, this is incredible. Yay to marriage equality. Yeah. Yay to our film.
Yeah.
And so he just happened to be painted. I mean, we had to cover one slogan that was like one love, same love or something like that at the end, because it became too obvious. So we covered that up. But it was done because of marriage equality.
Yeah. It was a cool location. I mean, even now, like maybe 6 months after we were there, I think the council painted it all white. So now it's just completely white. But yeah, when we were there, it had this really interesting character. And one of the other interesting things that happened is, when they obviously painted the walls, the brick walls, but they didn't paint the lights. So the lights still had the kind of the spray paint, kind of graffiti spray paint on it, which again, so you're kind of walking along, you know, the walls are kind of these purple and all these different colors, but then the lights maybe have red or orange or yellow coming through it. And it just created this really interesting sort of light context, you know, it's like a lightscape, you know, there was all these different things that really made it, the whole thing feel very surreal when you add a floating woman to it.
But then having said that, that night that we filmed, that was torrential rain. Like, we're forgetting that literally the third shoot day that we had torrential rain, as in there was rain like that became a river through that tunnel.
There's a 100-year storm
By the end of the night.
Yeah.
So we're on a time crunch. But to answer your question, you know, it's great to have locations like this that exist that are already textured, that are already have character to them, and we just need to do some tweaking here and there. But that's what we did with that tunnel.
Yeah. If we'd come to it and it was white like it is now, we maybe might have had to think about doing some some painting of it. You know, like not officially, but maybe just like, you know, in balaclavas or something like, oh, a week before our shoot, somebody came in and painted it exactly how we want it. What a
strange
surprise.
How that happened.
Oh, my God, you know. Well, we'll just have to accept it, you know. So, but, you know, luckily we came in and it was perfect, yeah.
Okay, it's my last location I want to go over. You have a dark alley with the little boy pushing a shopping cart.
Yes. Yeah.
Now, did you wait a certain time of night to shoot that? Because it looks pitch black.
Yeah. That was 2 a.m.
Yeah.
So that was our night shoot. And so, again, that is another area that has now been built up and apartments are there. And also a tunnel going underneath the road. So
we almost lost that location because of all this development that's happening in the area.
Yeah. But that was, pitch black, middle of the night. That was a long, tiring
it was great. But again, this is another one where Tony was driving along one night and just saw something out of the corner of his eye. And this is what I mean about like that whole, like when you know you're making stories or telling stories, or even if you're thinking for future stories, you're always keeping an eye out. Yeah. And so one night he was driving along and he just saw something out of the corner of his eye and sort of turned up this street and found out it was this cul-de-sac that had these gigantic old warehouses, but this whole stretch of that kind of alleyway had become like the walls had been used like a canvas for like giant graffiti murals and all that kind of stuff. And then at night he found out that the lighting wasn't like white light, which is a bit boring. It was this kind of yellowy orange light that gave the whole thing a kind of a weird texture. So,
but this stuff's hard to find, you know, like this was again around the corner from our house. These places exist, but again, they're being torn away.
Yeah.
That was
Location. We almost like, we literally, we had it locked in. We were good to go. We got asked to get permission from this one other kind of block. We like basically the way the councils work around here is they go, we don't really care. As long as you talk to the property owners around there and if they're happy for you to do something, then we don't really care, right? That's normally how it works. Unless you're a gigantic like Marvel shoot, because lots of Marvel things shoot in Australia now, and in which case they want money. They want your location fees. But for small shoots, they don't really care. But so we were going and we talked and we got an okay from all of the local owners, but then this one giant development happened where it was a warehouse one week and then the next week it was gone. And there's a huge tunnel, like a road tunnel that they're building in Sydney. They're building tunnels all over the place to get our like roads infrastructure to where it should have been 30 years ago. So they're finally doing some upgrades in Sydney. And these guys, they were so ruthless. Like we ended up just having to call them so many times that finally this Scottish project manager literally said to me on the phone, he's like, if I say yes to this.
Said in Scottish.
What is it?
Accent.
I can't do it.
I say yes to this.
That's right. He's like, if I say yes to this, will you stop calling me? And I'm like, yes, I will stop calling you if you say yes that we can shoot at 2 a.m. when you're going to be shut anyway. He's like, all right then, yes, I'll put it in an email. Stop calling me. And he hung up.
I love it. That's great. Yeah. Where'd you steal your shopping cart from?
we were stealing carts weeks prior, like, and you know, shopping carts are really quite small, you know, and we had to fit a larger man in this cart.
He's a very large man.
He's a former semi-professional wrestler.
He's a wrestler. He's a former wrestler.
He's hilarious.
He's a singer. He's actually really talented. And we're like, get in the trolley. Get naked and get in the trolley.
Yeah, get naked, get
in the
trolley.
And we had to search for a larger trolley. But all these shopping carts, we call them trolleys, they're so tiny. And so basically we found a big cart and our production designer, Laura Murray, worked on aging it, you know, like aging it, rusting it up, giving it character, you know, adding.
And he was in there for hours.
He was in there for hours. But the idea is these bodies, I guess in the show, in Risen, the kids from the West often basically they take bodies that have fallen, chuck them in trolleys, cart them around to neighboring, like, you know, houses, and basically terrorize residents by laying these bodies in doorways and saying $20 to move it, you know, that kind of thing.
It's like an extortion.
And so these trolleys are kind of are part of them, basically, and they kind of add character to them. They add their wares on them. They put their stuff in the trolleys. So it's their tool, basically, for their job and what they do to get money. So, yeah, it was important to give those trolleys character and give them kind of their own little personality, you know.
And he was a great sport to our actor, Joe Zappia. He's a baritone singer, former wrestler. He's one of those guys. He's probably a gypsy, you know what I mean? He can do anything. And, he's just a very cool dude. And we said, are you willing to take your shirt off and get in the trolley? He's like, absolutely.
So when you were writing this script, did you have casting in mind ahead of time? Or what I'm asking is, were the people of different ages, or you always knew what age the characters were going to be?
I had a very particular idea of who the characters were in my head visually. The lead boy, he was in my previous film, my previous short film. So I knew from the outset, you know, Sean will be played by him, you know.
I'm going to say who he is.
But the other thing I was going to say is that I was really conscious of making sure that the cast, just like the world, was diverse. So making sure that there was a whole lot of representation in the film, because, you know, in that world, in that particular space, there was difference. That's, you know, the there were lots That's of different people. And so we were very conscious about making sure that we worked with people that were from different backgrounds, essentially, and represented that world, you know.
And do you want to say who the lead actor is? Or?
Do you want to say? No, so our lead actor is called, his name's Zen McGrath, and he is coming up in a film.
Yeah, you're going to be hearing about this.
He's a talented boy. So I worked on him in a short called Pillar before this, and he was recommended to me through a casting agent, and he was just incredible. You know, sometimes you work with particularly children, it's like it's going to be great or not great, but, you know, just like animals or whatever. But he was just instinctive, you know, like no previous training, acting training. He was just a natural talent, you know. And I noticed directing him, I had to give him very little, you know. He just needed enough direction, and that was enough. Sometimes on one occasion, I remember over-directing him. I think it was a night shoot, and it was the wrong move. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just like he let him exist in that character, let him play that character as he plays it, because naturally he's fantastic, you know. And so he comes from a family of actors, you know, like, as in, when I say family, brothers. So his brother's younger brother, Winter, is in Raised by Wolves, you know, the HBO show series. He's the main kid in that. And his older brother, Gully McGrath, was in Dark Shadows with Johnny Depp. Controversial, don't you? He's in Lincoln. You know, so they are just artistic freaks, you know, that are naturally talented actors. And so when Zen came on board for my last film, Pile, he was just incredible. So I knew he was going to be the boy. He was going to be the character of Sean in Risen, and hopefully in the TV show too, you know, that we're developing as well. So he is ultra talented, and coming up, actually, he's in a film, you know, the film called The Father? With
Anthony Hopkins,
yeah. So the sequel to that, or I loosely say sequel, is called The Son, and Zen's the main. He's the son.
He's the son. With Hugh Jackman, Laura Dern.
Is a sequel to that film coming? I had no idea.
Yeah. Because I think it's two plays by the writer director Florian Zeller. So the son has So it's Hugh Jackman, Laura Dern, Anthony Hopkins is back. I don't know what role he plays. And then Zen McGrath as the son. So hopefully we got in early, you know, and then we'll never be able to book him again.
We're missing somebody we haven't discussed, your female lead.
Oh, Bernie. Oh, Bernie's incredible. So yeah, so she came to us, you know, the role is quite tough, you know, in the sense that the character's tough, you know, and we auditioned lots of different people. And then she came along, and Bernie's actually, look at our talented card. Bernie's a beatboxer, like, and a rapper as well. And she's just so talented. And she brought a real kind of gusto and this confidence to the role. Like, and it's funny, you write these characters, and then these kind of people come along and they inject all this additional kind of stuff into the characters. I'm like, wow, that's incredible. You know, and she just has this kind of cool about her, you know, where she would just deliver lines and they just sound so much better than what they were you know, in her way, you know. And then she'd give little nods here and there, you know, kind of really cool nods here and there, and add a bit of humor into moments that maybe there wasn't humor. And she was, yeah, I mean, she was great.
Yeah, we auditioned her, and so that Tony could focus on, you know, obviously doing the actual casting. I would often have to play opposite the people. So I, you know, at different times I played a floating woman or a child or whatever. And she was the first one who came in, Bernie, her name is, sorry, came into the interview and just, oh, sorry, into the audition. And like, you had to be intimidated by her at different times in terms of her performance. And, you know, when I'm playing, I was actually literally, I was like, oh man, I feel like she could beat the hell out of me. Like,
You peed a little, but it was
unbelievable.
She was great. Like, and Bernie Ventil, and she,
Bernie Ventil,
and yeah, she had this, she just brought this attitude that I didn't expect, you know, and yeah, incredible.
Sweetest person too, though. In 1 second, literally when we're into it and she's embodying the character, I feel like she's going to beat me to death. And the next minute, you know, she's going like, yeah, so I'm doing a beatboxing concert coming up. And she's just, she's the nicest person, but she just has those
fear and love
ability to just turn it on. Yeah.
Okay. I do want to discuss costume design. I love how real these people are dressed for this world. And it's not just your leads, even the people they have interaction with. Not so much the users. I'm not worried about that, but I do want some more information on that woman in the dress. It's not really identified, which I think says mom, but I could be wrong just the way he played with it. But I'll let the viewers decide. I don't want you to answer my questions because I think that might ruin the film. So costume design, where did this ideas come from all this? Because he's dressed differently than she is, and they're all dressed differently than the, I don't know what to say, the other people in the park, I guess is the easiest way I can describe them.
Yeah, so Sean's you know, comes from the Greens area, so the more affluent area. So we kind of enter the film with him kind of in this space, and we're not sure why he's there. And he's very different in this space physically through his costume. And so we when I worked with Caitlin Murray, who was the costume designer, we were very conscious about making sure that there was a difference in costume. So in the kind of West area, the Greater West area, which is the opposite of the Greens, a lot of these characters would kind of pick up clothes along the way. You know, it's this idea of one character, we have an actress called Moore Blessing, who's in a suit, in a men's suit, you know, and it's like, because she just collected that, you know, she found that along the way in a clothing bin
on a fallen body.
And that's the idea. It's like these, they kind of just grab these pieces as they go, and they're not always matching necessarily. I mean, her suit's matching because she's lucky that it really fit her. But you know, that's the idea. And then Sean's, again, a lot more well-dressed. You know, his mum the mother in the Black Void shots is the idea. Again, she is dressed in a way that is very different to everyone else, you know. So
kind of, again, it's funny you said Stepford Wives earlier. She does have a Stepford Wives kind of a vibe to it because that's the whole idea. Yeah.
That's the idea. And, you know, with Caitlin, I said, you know, she added blood. And I was always like, more blood on the costume, more dirt, almost to the point of ridiculousness. Because, you know, often you look at it, and in real life, you look at something and it looks really bloody, but on camera, it doesn't appear as bloody, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's like, and again, I say this to Pete, I was always reluctant to call this sci-fi because I'm so not a sci-fi person or even a horror person. I mean, I love horror films, but I do love horror films, but I never kind of saw myself as a sci-fi director, if that makes sense. It was more for me a drama that happened to play in this elevated world. That's how I saw it initially. Obviously, it's a sci-fi film.
Good. Because I'm like, what would you call this?
A kitchen sink drama.
No. A new genre. Let me write that down. Kitchen sink drama.
No, don't write that down. That's not a good thing.
Floating people drama.
It's not a good thing. No, but it's like, again, it was me being, when I started writing it, you know, I'm not fully into sci-fi necessarily, or wasn't before this. And so I kind of came in like this reluctant kind of director going, it's not sci-fi, it's elevated drama, you know. I mean, that's going away from answering your question. But what was the question again?
Oh, yeah, it's about costume. I got something to add to that. I will say, you know, and again, like, because I think you answered the question, but also back to, I guess, that collaboration, which I think was really important with Laura, our costume designer, is that, Caitlin, is that, you know, ultimately there was a really clear idea of making sure that each of the costumes represented the character. And I think one of the things that Caitlin did very well was to actually really understand, I guess, the personalities of the individual characters in the script and make sure that their costume gave off that vibe, you know. So, you know, Bernie as our other lead, you know, it's there's a real utilitarian kind of a cool edge to it. But then you look at More Blessing, for example, and, you know, hers is about authority in a kind of a power suit. And even though it's a frayed thing that she obviously found, it's about giving off the, because she kind of leads her gang. And it's about that idea of giving off power, but still in that context of that world of, you know, discovered clothes and that sort of stuff. And I think, you know, both Tony and Caitlin basically went through and really thought about that for each character to make sure that their personality was
having said that, though, clothing. When Bernie walked into the audition, she wore a part of that outfit with the straps. Outfit. Like there's a harness element to her outfit that she came into the audition with. And then I literally said, you need to wear that like for our shoot because, and you know, we dressed it up and you know, obviously dirted her top, but that element was so fantastic. That kind of, it was like a leather harness almost, like kind of straps that hung loose, you know, which
a military,
military, great. Cool
hip hop, military, urban kind of vibes to it.
So, that's it.
I do want to discuss Bloodstain, so thank you for bringing it up. I liked them. I thought they were on everybody. I did notice. Was that your plan to have everybody covered in blood?
Smeared. Yeah. The idea, because the idea is, I mean, these kids in particular are constantly interacting with these bodies, you know, and they're constantly kind of moving them and doing things with them. And so blood to them has a different meaning. You know, it's not like, oh, gross, you know, like it's kind of like it's just a part of the world, you know, just like a laborer gets their hands dirty, you know, in soil or a gardener, like it's that kind of feel. So, you know, there'll be streaks of blood on their face and their bodies and things like that, you know.
They don't mind eating when there's blood around, and
but there is a cute moment that I was very conscious about where Lucy, you know, she's kind of like the mother figure to Sean, or ends up being this kind of mother figure and this protector of Sean, I guess. And, you know, they're eating pizza and then she kind of cleans the sauce from his mouth.
Yes.
And I'm like, yet she is filthy. They're both filthy.
Yeah, she's got blood smeared on her face. And yet in that moment, she's like, oh, you've got some pizza sauce on your face. And wipes it off in this very gentle kind of a moment. But even I think it's also shown in some of the kind of a tiny bit of the violence as well. So there's obviously when that character, our wrestler, you know, our big man falls from the sky, and because he's obviously gotten reckless with the drug, and so he's untethered, and so he hurts himself, and there's blood coming from his head. But then, you know, Lucy has a moment where it's totally normal for her to very quietly, very respectful, then kind of break his neck and just finish him off, because she knows where he's basically done for. So, and all of those things I think are done with a sense of, I don't know, like normality. I think that's the whole point, is it's supposed to give that impression of this is just existing
but
in this world.
But to Sean, it's shocking because he's not used to this space. Yeah. He doesn't play in this space. You know, he lives beyond the wall on the other side.
He represents the audience. You know, his shock is supposed to be our shock, but the other characters, this is just their life.
Whatever.
Okay, I do want to discuss the pizza. You guys are hitting all my next questions. Was the pizza any good? Because it seemed to be in a very generic red and white box.
Yes. No. It was okay. I think it was a day and a half old.
Oh, yuck!
It was all those things. I got a friend of mine who does glamour photography for for food. He's like, and he works with a food stylist. And he said, everything's cold, nothing's edible. You know, if you see those pictures of like burgers in like McDonald's ads and that sort of stuff, and you see the ketchup is perfect. It's literally on there as a dot. Like they get a little sauce gun and they just, you know, squeeze
I've it. Seen them
so
do
there's
it.
Not even sauce through the whole thing, you know. So it was a bit like that. Like it had to, you know, I guess it's, you know, the idea, I think, and I don't want to talk across what Tony was going to say, but the idea is pizza is, we know it's cheap, it's accessible. Mm-hmm. And the idea of them is, you know, they're extorting this money from rich people. And I think Bernie actually even says, her character, Lucy, says, we only got one meal out of him at a certain point in the story.
Yeah,
we only got one meal out of the extortion. Yeah.
And often people confuse that sometimes with, is she a vampire? Are they eating? You know,
no.
But it's the idea. Okay, good.
Because you see the exchange of money.
You're smart enough to pay attention to that.
But that's the idea. It's they're surviving, you know, and so they're doing it to survive. They're doing it to eat. They're doing it to exist.
But pizza's such a if it was something that was more extravagant, it wouldn't fit within the world. But you think about it, like in Australia, one of the most accessible, there's corner stores and that sort of stuff everywhere that sell, you know, pizzas or kebabs are the two easiest things in the world to eat, like a doner kebab to get, and it's cheap, it's fast, and so in this world where, you know, they need something cheap and easy and quick,
and they need sauce on their face,
and they need sauce on their face to sell the story point. That's the whole idea. Is it's something to recognize as being something universally cheap and quick and easy.
Okay, the last thing I want to get into, and if you don't want to discuss, I understand. It's a drug, a form of heroin, because it really looks like you're heating it up one point on a spoon. And it's really bubbly, though. And I can't say I've ever done heroin nor investigated heroin, so I don't know if it's exactly the way heroin would work, but that's the way I think it does.
Yeah, so the drug is called RIZE, R-I-Z-E, and the idea is, it's a methamphetamine. So it's kind of similar to ice where, you know, the fastest way to take it is to inject it. So you heat it up because the ingredients are kind of, you know, the ingredients kind of bubble over and it activates ingredients, and then it's injected similar to heroin.
Mm. Yeah. And it's because it's keeping in mind that, I guess, you know, where this started with, Tony's original sort of observation was around, you know, these crises that are going on in the world, in America, in Australia. We have the same thing out here. It's happening in Europe and that, which is around these opioid crises and these methamphetamine crises and that sort of stuff. So it's very much mirrored on that, even though the effect of the drug is the side effect is the floating, but the reason why they do it, which is where that kind of memory of the woman in the black void comes in, is they take it because it takes you back to a lucid memory. So imagine you get to literally take a drug and you go back to whatever is your favorite memory
and relive that moment with whatever the same fervor, it is, with the same feeling,
and you live it first person and you re-experience it like you were there, and people just get totally addicted,
psychologically addicted, physically addicted. So that's kind of that's the biggest story world for the TV series. So you know, when you do take the drug, it takes you back to a kind of golden age, a memory that you want to get back to, you know, which makes the drug even harder to get off, you know, because you just want to go back to better times, you know, and that's understandable. And I mean, this is kind of diverting away from the question, but for me, like the I had this idea a while ago, but it started forming more in my head a couple of years ago when one of my good friends kind of became a functioning drug user, you know, and I felt very much like it was my secret. I was the only one that knew that they were functioning in that way. And I just wondered, and this idea came back to me, this image, I've always had this image of this floating boy, you know, this floating teen. And then he started becoming more addicted and kind of got deeper and deeper into the use, and behaved strangely. And I had to cover for them all the time and say, oh, they're late because of this, ha ha ha, you know, and that was difficult to do. And I just wondered in that moment, imagine there was a drug that you couldn't avoid, but you had to see it. Like it was visual. You couldn't avoid it. Society couldn't avoid it. It was there. It was obvious, you know? And that's kind of where I made that link with RIZEN. And that's kind of the origin of that story is kind of, I guess, selfishly my way. I'm like, if my friend, you know, was using, I wouldn't be the only one sharing that secret, and potentially they could get more help if people knew about it, you know? And so that was kind of the inception.
Yeah.
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 Okay, now it's time for some fun questions. Because it's your first time on the show, what's your favorite film?
Parasite.
Mm. Can I do two? They're equal.
I don't care.
Shawshank Redemption and The Usual Suspects are my two equal favorites.
Fair enough. One film that you always recommend to people but they never seem to watch.
That
is a great question. That is a great question.
My film.
I got one actually that I do, and it's funny enough, it's a sci-fi, and I actually think I've recommended it to you and you haven't watched it. I think it's called Code 46. It's this absolutely random Tim Robbins sci-fi about a future. And it's just so beautifully done. They shot it in like, I think Saudi Arabia and Shanghai. And it's a really grounded sci-fi. And it's about this future where you can't travel anywhere unless you get insurance. And basically because, there's viruses and disease all over the world. And so you get this real haves and have nots version, and insurance companies basically dominate the movement of peoples. And within that world, because we've been experimenting with genetics and we've been doing all these things, you find out that they're, people we've been cloning and we've been doing all these things around, fertilization, that it's possible that you could actually be dating somebody who you are actually a direct genetic relative to and you don't even know it. Like they could be 80% your mother or 90% your father, even though they don't look like it. And I think a code 46 violation is this idea of that if you two have a child, it's considered by society unacceptable for the two of you to, it's sort of like accidental incest. And it's this whole world. And then in the core of it is a love story. It's a beautiful, intense, amazing, poetic, but still with a great storyline that moves forward film. And nobody watches it.
I'm not going to watch it.
See, nobody watches it. And I try to tell people, I got it for $5. I saw it on, I was sick one day and I saw it on like, it was totally unexpected because normally over here at midday, there's like a midday movie thing that happens on our broadcast TV channels. And it's normally like Hallmark movies and all that kind of stuff, like Sarah Michelle Gellar in The Angel Whisperer Part 7, it's normally that's a, and one day this movie was on and it was just, and I was just absolutely gripped by it. And so I found it in a bargain bin for like $5 on DVD. And I tell people to watch it all the time. Nobody watches it.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry about that.
What's your one?
I'm trying to think. I mentioned Parasite already to you, and I've mentioned it a few times to people who haven't seen it. You saw it.
Okay, then they're idiots if they haven't seen Parasite.
I know, but you don't even have to.
Yeah.
He was reluctant. They kept saying, watch it.
So good.
But it's a film that cuts through everything. Even if you might think subtitles, I can't read subtitles. It's like, that doesn't matter. Like,
Did you just literally pick a Best Picture Oscar winner as your Nobody Listens?
I think you did, but I don't really count that. But listen, and it took you ages to watch it. I mean, you finally watched it, but it took you a long time. And like, how much convincing is required, Pete?
I feel like mine's actually much more valid.
I agree.
There's a Macedonian feature film called No Man's Land. And it's hard to get. It's like a war film. I think it was Oscar nominated for Best Foreign Film. I think.
See, that's a good pick. I'll give you that.
That's a good one. And the DVD is right there. Grab it. I've mentioned that a few times. People are like, but it's hard to find. Yeah. So I understand.
And also the three colors blue. You tell people to watch it all the time. Kozlowski. Three Colors Blue. Incredible film. Nobody watched it. Nobody seen it.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you for your time and have a great day.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.